organization says the world is now closer to an influenza pandemic in the past 40 years.
This morning on Health Watch, West Nile virus.
We reported yesterday about new cases of bird flu.
Swine flu is on the move.
75 students at a high school have now fallen ill with flu-like symptoms.
Is this a pandemic? A global epidemic?
There is a real possibility that this is the next pandemic.
In this post-SARS era, everyone is on high alert.
Evaluating old threats in a new light. Our government has no information that a smallpox attack is imminent. Yet it is prudent to prepare for the possibility.
The smallpox virus exists. It exists, we hope, under conditions of maximum security, but nobody can be sure.
Large epidemics and pandemics occur on a regular basis throughout history. And it will occur again. It definitely will.
This is the story of two plague years. One real, one imagined. Two stories with eerie similarities, separated by more than a century. What happens to a city under siege from a deadly epidemic? Every epidemic has a patient zero. The last time, in 1885, he was a train conductor, coming into Montreal at the end of February from Chicago. This time, let's say, she is a flight attendant, arriving on a flight from London. Somewhere in London, under mysterious circumstances, she was infected with the smallpox virus. Early symptoms are identical to the flu. Here in Montreal, they're getting worse. Sore joints, a cough, a fever. The next afternoon, she drags herself out of bed and heads for the nearest emergency. In the crowded waiting room, some patients have been waiting for 24 hours. She takes one look and heads back to her hotel, stopping at a drugstore to stock up on flu medicine, oblivious to everything around her. In London, meanwhile, a mysterious outbreak is making the news. Health authorities reassure the population that there is no reason for concern. So it begins. The virus enters on quiet feet when we least expect it. Montreal, 1885. The city of some 200,000 is a tinderbox waiting for a match. French and English, Catholic and Protestant, locked in an uneasy dance. By reputation, the city of wealth and death. Mansions spread out on the slope of the mountain, crowded slums below. and one of the highest infant mortality rates in the world. On the night of February 28th, while well-to-do Montrealers are celebrating winter with skating parties and fireworks, a young doctor named Thomas Roger is summoned by the Grand Trunk Railway to see a patient. The patient is George Longley, a conductor who has fallen ill on the train from Chicago. Dr. Roger's worst fears are confirmed. The conductor is infected with smallpox, the Red Death. The red spots of smallpox grow into blisters all over the body, killing one in three, leaving survivors scarred, some blind, or crippled for life. Longley himself has only a mild case. In anyone he infects, the smallpox could turn fatal. Dr. Roger is vaccinated, but many in the city's poor neighborhoods, especially young children, are not.
The doctor's first inclination is he's English. Take him to the English hospital, Montreal General. The people there say, if he's got smallpox, he doesn't stay here, because we can't put our patients at risk. There is a smallpox hospital. Why didn't you take him to the Montreal Smallpox Hospital? Well, the problem was that that was a little old ramshackle building that had been set up during years when there was a lot of smallpox in the city, but it was closed because there hadn't been any in Montreal for 5 years. So what to do?
Le docteur Rogers s'est en allé chez le docteur Ingston, William Ingston, qui était le chirurgien en chef à l'Hôtel-Dieu, parce que le docteur Ingston était irlandais, catholique. Les catholiques étaient admis à l'Hôtel-Dieu de Montréal et les protestants au Montréal général. Et c'était divisé sur une base de religion. Il était rendu 11h minuit le soir à sa maison. Il discute avec le docteur Ingston, qui finalement accepte de signer un billet pour le faire admettre à l'Hôtel-Dieu.
Hingston will later deny knowing it is a case of smallpox. Dr. Roger assumes Hingston's note contains the diagnosis and says nothing to the nursing sisters at Hôtel-Dieu. As for the nuns on night duty, they take one look at Longley, assume it is chickenpox, and find him a bed.
In the build-up to great catastrophes, everything goes wrong. Small things as well as big things go wrong. You have little misunderstandings and chains of misunderstandings, and some things we'll never know the answer to. We don't know exactly what people thought that night.
Dr. Roger heads home to his own warm bed. George Longley is now Hotel Dieu's problem. The next morning, the flight attendant awakes to a nasty surprise. She decides against another trip to the emergency and calls a health hotline. Over the phone, the nurse tells her it's most likely chickenpox and she should go to a clinic. But call first to warn them she might be contagious. Instead, she decides to call in sick and hide out in her hotel room until the spots disappear. The first link in the chain of misunderstandings. Like George Longley, the flight attendant is extremely lucky to have only a mild case. She takes her pills, tries to sleep. After a time, the pustules scab over and drop off. The fever breaks, and her appetite returns at last. The day after leaving George Longley at the Hotel Dieu, Dr. Roger returns to the contaminated railway car with an assistant. Dragging out all the blankets and cushions, dousing them in coal oil, and setting them on fire, hoping to stop the deadly infection in its tracks.
There is a story of a nun coming in to see Longley the day after he was admitted, taking a look at him and exclaiming, "Oh, sir, you have smallpox. Why aren't you in the English hospital?" And he said, "They wouldn't have me." And she said, "Well, we are very glad to have you here." The sense of a duty to care.
The nuns quickly put Longley in isolation. After 3 weeks, he is released from the Hotel Dieu. He describes it as a poor place for pleasure, but middling good for relaxation, and heads back to Chicago on the next train. For a brief moment, it seems the spark of smallpox has been extinguished. As for the flight attendant, she reports for work and heads off to the airport, still believing it was a freak case of chickenpox. The hotel maid never meets the guest in room 610, never knows she was sick, and that everything in the room is contaminated. Before long, the hotel maid starts feeling sick. Then the red spots appear and get worse.
If somebody showed up in the emergency with early symptoms of smallpox, which are actually quite nonspecific, they're more like a flu-like illness, the chance to be recognized are very, very small, if not inexistent.
Very, very few doctors would recognize smallpox. They don't even recognize measles anymore. We've essentially eradicated measles in Canada. So these are diseases that haven't been around for a long time.
Everybody, I think, would say, "I think this is chickenpox, therefore we should isolate them." Getting that organized, making it happen, could take a little while sometimes. When you walk into an emergency room today, you realize that the actual waiting room has not just people waiting, but people who have already been seen and are on stretchers. There's no place to put them, and so they're actually in the waiting room with everybody else.
The resident who finally comes to examine the hotel maid is puzzled by the severity of her symptoms.
If a resident came up and says, "Look, this is not chicken pox, this is something quite unusual," we would bring in probably a dermatologist and an infectious disease specialist to take a look at the case.
If I had a concern, if for some reason I looked at this rash and said, "This is odd, and in particular, I'm worried even remotely about something like smallpox," then all the alarm bells would go off.
The infectious disease specialist takes samples from the now isolated patient, sends them off to the ultra-secure National Microbiology Lab in Winnipeg, and waits anxiously for the results. March 23rd, 1885. The nursing sisters of Hotel Dieu have been holding their breath as well. 2 days after Longley is released, an Acadian servant girl working in the hospital comes down with a fever and breaks out in red spots. The nuns immediately place her in quarantine. On April 1st, Pélagie Robichaud dies, and her name otherwise long forgotten, goes down in medical history. The first death of the 1885 epidemic. The gravediggers in Notre-Dame-des-Neiges cemetery light a fire to soften up the frozen ground. Pelagie's body is quickly placed in a double coffin to keep the disease from spreading and buried without ceremony. 5 days after Pelagie dies, her sister Marie is diagnosed with hemorrhagic smallpox, the black pox, which spreads internally. The organs simply melt. Victims beg for death, and it comes quickly. The virus has begun to spread. So far, no word of smallpox has leaked out. Instead, Montreal's 9 newspapers report that the city is bracing for an outbreak of cholera when the ice melts. There is news of the local regiment, sent off to put down the rebellion in Western Canada led by Louis Riel. No word that the city's health committee ordered the smallpox hospital reopened, because the press were excluded from the debate.
It took an enterprising reporter from one of the newspapers, I think it was The Witness, to check the death returns and find out that this was happening. They thought they were going to contain the smallpox. Yes, a few people have died of smallpox. Okay, well, that happens, and we can control it. Sort of like C. difficile in hospitals today. Yeah, we're losing some people, but no need to be alarmed.
But the cover-up is doomed. New smallpox cases appear at Hotel Dieu day after day. Back to the Montreal General. The next day, the hospital gets an urgent call from the lab in Winnipeg. The tests are positive for smallpox. The hospital is ground zero for the disease.
Titre principal ce soir. La variole est apparue à Montréal. Selon les autorités,
a reporter with a contact inside the hospital breaks the story, and the rest of the media scramble to catch up.
Even if there was a whispering of smallpox, we'd be all over it, there's no question. But how quickly would you get the information? I'm not sure. I think you'd get it pretty quickly. We knew about SARS, you know, almost as quickly as the medical authorities, because people talk.
The patient's identity is not released. In London, England, more than 20 cases of smallpox have now been confirmed, and cases are showing up in cities around the world. Within hours of the story breaking, journalists scramble to file reports explaining how the deadly disease could return from the grave to stalk humanity once again.
By 1979, according to international agreement, all stockpiles of the virus were to be either destroyed or shipped to one of two laboratories, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, or a similar facility in the Soviet Union, for final destruction at a date to be determined. Then, as the Soviet Union collapsed, disturbing rumors started leaking out. Defecting scientists confirmed that even as Soviet doctors were fighting to wipe out the disease in the rest of the world, the Soviet military was engaged in a massive secret program to develop smallpox as a weapon of biowarfare. The program was eventually canceled. The man in charge before he defected to the United States was Kanajan Alibakov. Now he worries about his former staff.
Thousands of people know how to work with smallpox virus, and where these people are and what they're doing, of course, nobody knows, and it makes me nervous. On suspecte une attaque bioterroriste et les forces de sécurité du monde
our scenario, the investigation into the outbreak leads the police here, to a laboratory in the north of London. A lab technician has vanished, leaving traces of smallpox behind. No clue where he got the virus and why. An experiment gone terribly wrong? Or a terrorist plot? No one claims responsibility. The investigation continues.
Infectious disease outbreaks are different than bombs, than natural disasters. They last, and there is a sense that you can bring it home.
With smallpox, just knowing that somebody had their hands on it would create a panic that was unprecedented in the world. It's the biggest, one of the biggest killers in history. It's often said smallpox killed more people than war, and there's no question it did. So that very fear is enough to do a lot of damage.
We have an emergency management plan, and if somebody were to say the word smallpox in our emergency room, once that was said, things would happen pretty fast.
Dr. Langton, neurology consultation. Dr. Fortier.
Dr. Iskander, psychiatry.
There would probably be a fair sense of panic within the staff. Patients that have been coming through the emergency in that surrounding area would have to be advised that they might have been exposed and they would have to isolate themselves. This, at that point, falls into the hands of the public health authorities.
The plan, smallpox, is essentially a worldwide emergency. It's not just a city or a province or a country. I mean, the minute anybody thinks that they have a smallpox case, everybody from the local public health to the provincial public health, to the Canadian public health, to the CDC, to the World Health Organization, suddenly becoming incredibly excited.
We'll be sending notifications very rapidly within the provinces to the hospital so that we can tell physicians smallpox has reappeared. Please look out for the following symptoms. And we may send them photographs of examples of what smallpox might look like. The main part of the national contingency plan for smallpox is a strategy that we call search and contain. So you need to know all the different contacts that the case may have. And public health will need to then chase up all of those contacts.
Who of the hotel maid's contacts is infected? And who brought the disease to Montreal and infected her? The task is monumental. Hotel guests come and go, and patient zero is long gone.
Once we found the contacts are quarantined, provided with vaccination in order to form a ring of protection around that case.
Well, you know, it's easy on paper to say who's in charge. I think the plan looks pretty top down. In reality, the local people are who really matter because they're going to be there. And in practice, I think, we saw this with SARS, that nobody was really in charge. We, in Canada, often become victims of our government arrangements. And that's unfortunate, and it would be tragic in a case of an infectious illness like this. I don't hold out a lot of faith that things would be, that there would be somebody in charge quickly enough.
Health authorities are warning Montrealers not to visit hospital emergency rooms.
A hotline is quickly set up. The wing of a hospital is turned into an isolation ward, and shipments of vaccine are rushed to the city. But how many have already slipped through the rings of containment, spreading the virus wherever they go? April 1885. In the days following the deaths of Pélagie and Marie, new cases continue to appear in the Hôtel Dieu's crowded wards. The hospital board decides all the patients will have to be sent home and the hospital disinfected from bottom to top.
This turned out to be a really disastrous decision because in sending home people from Hotel Dieu who were contaminated with smallpox, you then move smallpox onto the streets of Montreal. Now it was abroad in the city.
On est à une époque, en 1885, où la médecine, évidemment, est beaucoup moins évoluée qu'aujourd'hui. Dans ce temps-là, on faisait appel à des miasmes. On appelait l'air vicié, on appelait ça miasme, et plusieurs maladies qui étaient transmissibles comme ça d'une personne à l'autre, on disait qu'elles étaient dues à des miasmes.
April 15th, the health committee admits publicly that there is an epidemic of smallpox in the city. Public vaccinators immediately go to work, vaccinating anyone for free. But there are only two of them, for a population near 200,000. Private doctors charge a dollar, a laborer's entire daily wage, to vaccinate just one child.
Vaccination by 1885 was a relatively tried and true procedure in which a little bit of cowpox virus was scratched onto the skin of a person, creating in them a small surface dose of cowpox, which created antibodies that gave protection against smallpox.
Mais il y a eu beaucoup de résistance. C'était la première fois dans l'histoire de la médecine qu'on prévenait une maladie en donnant une autre maladie. Alors ça faisait peur aux gens. Puis d'autant plus que cette autre maladie provenait d'un animal, en particulier la vache.
In the English community, the pressure to get vaccinated is hard to resist. Editorials in newspapers, even the clergy from their pulpits, urge vaccination. On the streets, people stop each other and compare vaccination scars. Not so in the French community. There, editorials dismiss the smallpox outbreak as English hysteria, and the priests in their pulpits are silent.
Worse than that, you begin to get really disturbing reports that people are saying there's something wrong with the vaccine, or the vaccine is causing sickness.
The rumors are true. The vaccine in use turns out to be contaminated. The English doctor in charge of supplying the vaccine is fired, but the damage is done. For opponents of vaccination, the bad vaccine is a golden opportunity.
Le médecin canadien-français qui s'est opposé le plus à la vaccination a été le docteur Emery Coderre, qui était un professeur à la faculté. On dit, mais ça n'a pas été prouvé, on dit que trois de ses enfants seraient morts à la suite de la vaccination. C'est plausible que ce soit la cause de son opposition au vaccin.
His ally in the English community is the so-called Dr. Alexander Milton Ross. His medical training is in the radical field of hydrotherapy. Drink only water, eat no meat, stay away from tobacco and whiskey, and renounce masturbation. Though his medical training is shaky, as a propagandist, A.M. Ross has few equals. In a letter published in the Herald, Ross calls vaccination
the direct means of poisoning the lifeblood of our race with foul and dangerous diseases. Diseases peculiar to cattle. I believe vaccination to be a monstrous fallacy and vulgar error unworthy of the intelligence of the 19th century.
After long and angry debate, on May 11th, the health committee backs down and suspends public vaccination. Like releasing the infected patients from Hotel Dieu, it is another terrible decision, guaranteeing the smallpox will spread. More than a century after the 1885 epidemic, vaccination is widely considered the answer to any contagious disease. But smallpox vaccine raises a host of troubling questions.
The amount of smallpox vaccine that Canada has stockpiled is just over 6 million doses, which is not enough to vaccinate the whole of the population of Canada. But because our key strategy is to surround the case and to put rings around the case itself, it may or may not take very much vaccine. If there are more cases in a community, it's possible that a community might have to be vaccinated, and that will involve more vaccine.
That's obviously been a matter of some controversy because there is no currently available, widely available, licensed vaccine. For the moment, although people are working and testing new vaccines, what we have is essentially stocks of old vaccine. And old, I mean more than 30 years old, that have been sitting in freezers. How good is that old vaccine? How many people could we possibly vaccinate with our current stock? Some of those basic questions we don't even know. The issue of who would we vaccinate, well, you know, obviously there's going to be some element of panic. And when there's some element of panic, you can have all the ideas you want about how you're going to distribute this and who's going to get it. But there's going to be problems.
The key element is doing it early, getting some key people vaccinated, about 500 early, mainly doctors, health professionals, so they can vaccinate other people. Because I think if there was a hint of smallpox, people would be stampeding to get their vaccines.
The problems are not just logistical with a vaccine as powerful as the one developed against smallpox.
Smallpox vaccine has one of the highest rates of side effects of some of the vaccines that we have. Certainly with the vaccine you can get a fever. Maybe at least 10% of people could get a fever.
The biggest problem is what happens with people who have immune system deficits, which they may or may not know about. There are people with various diseases who haven't been diagnosed yet. I mean, as you know, a lot of people with HIV in North America don't actually even know they're infected.
There's some complications, including a generalized spread of the vaccine virus throughout your body that can cause a bigger rash. It can result in inflammation of the brain or of the heart as well. And so these are pretty serious.
In the midst of a spring snowstorm, the smallpox outbreak claims its first victim, the hotel maid. Her death is hushed up, and the funeral is held in private to avoid publicity. The media have discovered that many of the first to be infected are from the city's Caribbean community. The hysteria begins.
we're on the air. Yes.
I'm telling you, I've got nothing against these people. But it's like AIDS all over again.
Well, I mean, hang on.
How come when these immigrants...
Montrealers stay away from Caribbean stores and restaurants. Black children are called names in the schoolyard. Businesses start to suffer. The Caribbean community is under siege.
There was always this notion that somebody brought it in. During the plague in Europe, it was the Jewish community that was hit. In HIV, it was the Haitian and the gay community, which inappropriately were stigmatized and targeted. During SARS, it was the Asian community. The stigmatization of groups targeted as causal in bringing in has not changed. The groups always tended to be not the rich and powerful of the society. Historically, they tended to be the immigrants, the people that came from the outside.
But that's existed throughout history. We've always had the, you know, the person who's identified with starting an epidemic, whether it's smallpox in Montreal or SARS in Toronto. There's always a name, or the cow who kicked over the lamp in Chicago and burned down the city. There's always a scapegoat, and that's almost inevitable, I think.
Blaming the immigrants is an old story. And in 1885, the newcomers are largely French-Canadian, migrating to the city of Montreal from the countryside in search of a better life, working in the mostly English-owned factories.
There are political issues in Canada that have been dividing English and French for generations. And now you've got a disease issue that cuts right through the central fault line. And of course, bigotry generates bigotry. And expressions of that bigotry start seeping into the newspapers.
Du côté francophone, c'était la Minerve qui s'opposait à la vaccination et qui appelait d'ailleurs la variole le mal des Anglais, qui est venu par un Américain de langue anglaise. Et chez les anglophones, le journal le plus violent a été le Herald contre les Canadiens français. Le Herald est tombé tout de suite dans le racisme.
An anonymous writer offers his own radical solution to the smallpox problem.
Let English capitalists, manufacturers and employers of labor drop off all the French help. Have only English-speaking people who are vaccinated and who are not afraid to use soap and water. And it will soon be seen how that will stir up action.
Il y a eu beaucoup de réponses à cette lettre-là, en lui disant que le journal n'aurait pas dû publier cette lettre, qui était une lettre raciste.
The response was to be properly outraged. That's not true, but of course, it's French Canadians who are dying of smallpox. Most of the victims, unvaccinated children, mostly in the poor quarters of the East End.
By the middle of May, some 25 have died, and another 50 have been infected. And then, something happens. As the annual floodwaters recede, the number of new cases starts to decline. On June 1st, there are only a dozen patients in the smallpox hospital, and no new cases at all. So it is this time around. Schools all close early for the summer, and children are sent home, supposedly to be quarantined indoors. The rings of vaccination throughout the city seem to be working, and the number of new cases declines every week. Under pressure from the business community, City Council decides the summer festivities can go ahead as usual. In this cold northern city, summertime is festival time. Even the annual Caribbean Festival draws packed crowds, now that the finger pointing has died down.
In Montreal in the summer of 1885, there are always religious processions going on. Montreal soldiers have gone off to fight the rebellion in Western Canada, and now they come home, and you have a parade to welcome your soldiers. The big event in the summer of 1885 was when Buffalo Bill appeared with his Wild West show. Everybody has to go to see that. You can imagine the little children pleading with their mothers, "Oh, my spots are just about gone." Every one of these gatherings becomes a kind of cauldron for the fires of smallpox to spread a little bit further.
Crowd after crowd after crowd spreading the virus. Even the flight attendant, long since recovered, returns to the city whenever her schedule permits. Does she have any idea of her role in this deadly drama? In July, clusters of new cases start to appear. Soon there are 50 a week. Once again, the media sound the alarm,
bringing the total since the outbreak to more than 1,500, including 236 deaths.
More vaccine is rushed to vaccination centers around the city. The World Health Organization warns visitors to stay away from Montreal. The panic spreads, and anyone who can leaves the city. So it is in the summer of 1885. An exodus as the rich close up their mansions, leaving the servants to stand guard and head up the river to their cottages or to fashionable summer resorts. In the working class areas of the city, there is no escape from the growing number of sick and dying.
You wanted to bury smallpox cases as fast as possible. Get them into bags and coffins and get them into the earth. They were highly contagious. Families want to mourn their dead. Families want to have proper burials of their dead. They're not allowed to do this.
Throughout the blazing hot days of summer, the black smallpox van becomes a familiar sight, trundling up and down the streets of the East End, Saint-Dominique, Saint-Laurent, Wolfe, Montcalm, Visitation, come to take away the sick, mostly children, to the overcrowded smallpox hospital. By mid-July, the number of dead is close to 200, with another 400 infected. And the epidemic is only just beginning to gather momentum. By the end of July, the number of new smallpox cases reaches 150 a week. Now the question is, where to put them? Public health authorities are forced to set up temporary smallpox hospitals in designated buildings across the city.
The outbreak would, at the start, spin a little bit out of control. Diagnoses would be made late, people would be exposed, there would be some chaos, there would be some lack of cooperation. Disease would spread more than we would want it to. Theoretically preventable, but things wouldn't happen the way we planned.
Medical supplies, equipment, and vaccine stocks pour in. Volunteer medical workers from across the country and the U.S. arrive to help staff the temporary hospitals, doing what they can for the infected. More and more of them every day. August 1885. With the death toll in the hundreds, the city's health authorities ask the Grey Nuns and Sisters of Providence to begin door-to-door visits in the worst-hit areas of the city. They fan out from their convents, offering whatever assistance they can, food, clothing, and the small sums of money the city has authorized them to distribute, with strict orders not to give any to families that include drinkers. The nuns record what they find.
11 personnes contaminées dans la même maison. Le père, un peu plus seul.
11 infected in the same house. The father, a bit stronger, struggles to take care of the others.
2 infants dead. A boy of 19 dying, ruined and half dead for days.
Every day, and some days twice, we have been visiting to bring help. The young man dies, his body falling in pieces.
We scrubbed and washed from top to bottom, killing many of the rats who were everywhere, washing the poor victims every day. 85 Vigée Street, Sarah Hinault, age 33, and Alexis Frappier, age 41. Married 15 years, they have 7 children.
At the beginning of September, Albertine, age 10, dies, followed shortly by the oldest child, Joseph Albert, age 12. Only 2 survive, Berthe, age 10, and Arthur Alexis, 6.
In the blazing days and stifling nights this summer, tenement rooms are like ovens. People take to their balconies for relief. Tempers snap. Many in the city's working class neighborhoods work from home, taking in laundry, or sewing or baking, or live above a store. The placards warning customers away mean disaster. Attempts by the health police to quarantine infected houses is met with fierce resistance.
containment only works if people are willing to be contained. Now, how are you going to stop the smallpox from spreading?
The toll continues to rise. Some 500 dead in the month of August alone. Rumors start to spread about the conditions inside the smallpox hospital.
As you began filling it with cases, it became a ghastly hellhole. Understaffed, no significant treatments. The kinds of personnel who would do this job were some of the dregs of the healthcare community. And so the smallpox hospital became a fearsome place.
A reporter for the Montreal Herald tracks down 16 former patients and records their testimony.
You awaken at night at the hospital to hear the noises of smallpox. The thump of a patient writhing in pain and fever and delirium who falls out of bed. Mugs clang on metal bed frames.
Water, water for Gus. Give me some water.
You get up if you can and get some water from the pail for your fellow patient.
Close the window. I'm cold.
It rains, and the rains come through the open window. You shiver under your blanket, the wool fibers running into your pustules. When they close the windows, the stench is unbearable. If you're brought into the hospital at night, the attendant will motion you to go and find a bed somewhere. It may just be emptied by death, the linen unchanged. There appears to be no remedy. No relief for the victims of the black pox, many of whom are children. The victims moan and cry out, die with no one at their side, not even a priest, and are carried off and jammed into coffins. Some say that two or three bodies are sometimes put in the same coffin. If the cries are coming from the bad, the black ward, where they keep the worst cases, you're too frightened to do anything. Maybe an attendant will come. They're often too busy for that ward. If the inmates stagger to the door or come out, the other patients run away. Cries from the heart of darkness fade to hoarse whispers. Eventually, they stop.
L'Organisation mondiale de la santé a annoncé que Montréal figure désormais sur la liste of quarantine cities.
All commercial flights into or out of Montreal have been canceled.
Mid-August, with school openings 2 weeks away, health authorities weigh the risk of side effects, then announce compulsory vaccination of the entire city. Students without vaccination certificates will be turned away at the door. A strict quarantine order goes into effect. Those who refuse vaccination and quarantine will be detained.
Tonight, confirmation of the first known death due to the smallpox vaccine.
At the beginning of September comes the first death due to the side effects of the vaccine.
The unidentified man was suffering from immune deficiency.
While most of the frightened population comply, some refuse to be vaccinated.
Dans la majorité des campagnes de vaccination, on commence par, je dirais, surestimer les risques inhérents à la maladie, surestimé l'efficacité du vaccin. Et donc, créer un sentiment de panique chez la population qui va l'inciter à utiliser le vaccin.
People's resistance to being vaccinated, I have to tell you, is one of the mysteries of human psychology, at least as far as I'm concerned. Vaccination is probably the single greatest medical achievement in all of medical history. Forget about all our drugs and antibiotics and operations and all these things. There's nothing that's had more of an impact on the general health of the world than vaccination. So, to me anyway, that is absolutely clear. It's not even worth debating. Nonetheless, you have knowledgeable, educated, otherwise reasonable people who do have a resistance, and it just goes to show humans don't behave rationally.
Health authorities are taking no more chances of the smallpox spreading. Police are sent to padlock every business suspected of being contaminated with the disease.
I think the public has to know this is one of the worst case scenarios in terms of an infectious disease outbreak, in that their cooperation is sought. If there are people who are non-compliant, there are definitely laws and public health powers that can quarantine people in mandatory settings. It's potential you could track people, put bracelets on their arms, have police and other setups to ensure quarantine is undertaken. It is better to be preemptive and precautionary and take the heat of people thinking you might be overreactionary, get ahead of the curve, and then think about whether you've overreacted later. But it's such a serious situation that I think decisive early action is the key.
Police checkpoints are set up on all the bridges, and everyone leaving the city is required to show proof of vaccination. Those who refuse to cooperate are taken away to temporary detention centers. The streets and highways of the city are eerily quiet as the sick remain in quarantine and the healthy stay at home, hoping to escape being infected. The outside world turns its back on Montreal, just as it did once before.
By the end of the summer of 1885, the world was starting to realize there's something seriously wrong in Montreal. There were just too many stories coming out of the city about smallpox. The climate of fear of smallpox began to envelop all of North America, and Montreal was the place that you feared.
The boycotting of Montreal begins. Hotels are silent as tourists go elsewhere and conventions are canceled.
Montréal, à ce moment-là, était, il y avait des industries. On fabriquait beaucoup de souliers. Les cigares de Montréal étaient les plus réputés. Et on voyait les affaires baisser parce que les gens avaient peur d'acheter des souliers fabriqués à Montréal et également de fumer des cigares venant de Montréal. Donc, les affaires périclitaient.
Basic goods are in short supply, as freight workers, long-distance truckers, and ship crews are reluctant to risk stopping in Montreal. Factories close. Stores are boarded up. Workers are laid off. For thousands of unemployed in the city, starvation is not far away.
And we think it can't happen, but it has happened. And when the SARS virus struck Toronto, the sense of deja vu was absolutely stunning. We were seeing attitudes and concerns spring up again that echoed 19th century responses to epidemics in the most eerie kind of way. We were seeing the rest of the world beginning to boycott Toronto because of SARS, just as Montreal had been boycotted in 1885. We're seeing public health authorities teetering on the edge of a breakdown as they try to enforce isolation on people. We're also seeing fear of germs, a fear of poison viruses on such a scale that you were beginning to wonder where rationality could be found. September and October of 1885, the veneer of civilization begins to crumble. You've got now hundreds of people dying of smallpox a week in Montreal.
Le bureau de santé était convaincu que seule la vaccination pouvait empêcher la variole de s'étendre. Donc, on a proposé la vaccination obligatoire.
Though all the powerful voices, including the Catholic Church, are calling for compulsory vaccination, many in the streets are prepared to resist.
September 28th. Angry crowds assemble in front of the health office on St. Catherine Street. Speeches are made. The crowd applauds and jeers at the authorities. Someone casts the first stone. One of the health office windows shatters. And the others. After half an hour, a cry goes up, "À l'Hôtel de Ville!" to City Hall. The crowd, 1,000 strong, heads off down St. Catherine Street, stoning all front windows. Then masses in front of City Hall, shouting, "Down with compulsory vaccination!" All the police in the building are issued rifles with bayonets. The chief of police arrives at last, orders the rifles put away, and organizes sallies of club-wielding policemen who gradually drive off the angry crowd. By 1 in the morning, the rioters have fled, and the city is quiet again. About 2 o'clock, people living near City Hall report being awakened by sobbing and wailing from outside. A woman, dressed in rags, walks alone along the street, carrying an infant who's dying of smallpox. Mother and child have been turned out by the people at the house where they were staying. The onlookers hear the terrible story, turn out their lights, and go back to bed.
dans les maisons, on ne pouvait pas isoler les enfants, qui, je ne sais pas, 3, 4, 5 enfants qui avaient la variole. On ne pouvait pas les isoler. Et c'est pour ça que les autorités ont essayé d'aller chercher les enfants presque de force pour les amener à l'hôpital. Et les parents souvent s'opposaient à se séparer de leurs enfants et on résistait. C'était une résistance violente. Et c'est là que se situe l'affaire Gagnon. La famille Gagnon avait quelques enfants, dont un grand adolescent, et les plus jeunes étaient atteints de la variole, et on a voulu aller les chercher. Le père a menacé les policiers, il a menacé les policiers de leur tirer dessus si ils amenaient les enfants. Alors, le maire Beaugrand a finalement donné aux policiers d'aller les chercher et les sortir morts ou vivants.
As the number of dead continues to rise, the city now has to face an awful new logistical question. What to do with all the bodies?
For now, for Montreal, we believe close to 2,000 places. We can upgrade this for twice, but hope that we don't need to go there. But let's say that all the body has to be cremated. The problem is that we don't have enough machine cremator to do this. And even if they work 24 hours a day, it won't be suitable because those machines are not built to work as this.
Le dilemme pour nous, c'est qu'on est capable d'opérer davantage, de faire plus de crémation, plus d'enterrement également. Par contre, comme on a déjà un plan préparé, puis qu'on prévoit que 33% des employés pourraient être malades, pourraient être touchés par une épidémie, c'est une des inquiétudes que nous avons.
The biggest problem, I think, in a pandemic, and our pandemic plan talks about this in Canada a lot, is what happens when the essential workers don't go to work. And I'm not talking about the doctors and nurses. I think they sort of have a code of ethics, and they're going to be there, most of them. But what happens when the Hydro-Quebec workers don't go to work and we don't have electricity? And smallpox happens in the winter. That's the real disaster that's going to happen, and we forget about those people. What happens when the guy who delivers the milk says, hey, I'm not going in my truck. I'm not going to die to deliver milk. That's the real issue if a disease hits.
The first thing is to have our people at work. That's the first thing you have to do, because you need their help. I think it will be the same thing as everyone in the medical system or, let's say, funeral homes. Some people will be really afraid to be contaminated, and they are going to decide to do not come to work. Let's say, by law, it says that you have to order them to come back, but if they don't want, they don't want.
Well, the dilemma for the staff is very real. Are you going to come to work? If you come to work, are you going back to your family while this is going on? This is something that a lot of the staff in Toronto went through during the SARS epidemic, and these become very personal decisions by the staff.
There is a bit of a tendency for healthcare workers to feel somewhat invulnerable. However, I think SARS did change that. I think most of the healthcare workers that I know are fully aware that some healthcare workers got sick and some died from SARS, and that is bound to change the mentality of at least some people. And if smallpox were to come around, the number of people who are afraid to work, I think, would be higher than it was during SARS.
In the last weeks of October, the crisis in the temporary smallpox hospitals comes to a head. Hundreds with smallpox symptoms, real or imagined, flock to the hospitals day and night, demanding treatment. There are not enough beds, not enough medicine, or blankets, or supplies.
The primary reason we are not prepared is because the key to preparedness is to have a robust healthcare system. And it's very difficult to imagine that if we have an influx of large number of cases, not small number of cases of anything can be handled, but a large number of cases where you're talking about thousands of ill individuals, we are not prepared because our emergency rooms are full. There is a healthcare manpower shortage. So it's not likely at this moment that we would be capable of handling it.
The medical staff are exhausted. The patients are frightened. So many essential workers either unwilling or unable to report for work, the city is experiencing rotating power outages. The media are flooded with complaints. Finally, the government is forced to act.
À la demande du Premier ministre du Québec, l'armée canadienne a été mandatée pour aider avec la crise de variole à Montréal.
The army is called out. The first time troops have been seen on the streets of the city since the ice storm of 1998. Soldiers are stationed at the smallpox treatment centers to help cope with the flood of desperate patients. Curfew is announced, and police are put on full alert. When all public gatherings are cancelled, including the first hockey games of the season, Montrealers take to the streets in protest. Fear stalks the city, and everyone is looking for a scapegoat for the epidemic. Someone is responsible. Someone failed.
Again, the example of plagues is like fires. At what point are they going to burn out of control? And when fires rage out of control, the devastation can be just awful. In the last days of 1885 in Montreal, most of the tumult and the shouting had died down, the rioting had stopped, and there was just a kind of grim street by street, house by house wrestling with the smallpox, stamping out burning ruins of fires one house at a time.
More labor unrest this week at Montreal cemeteries, where workers are protesting the longer hours and the dangers of infection.
Eventually, there's this return to normalcy, whatever the new normal is. And, you know, humans are very, very adaptable to whatever. So the new normal can be a really horrific situation, but people get back to their lives pretty quickly.
Finally, in November, vaccination and quarantine turn the tide, and the number of new smallpox cases starts to recede. Monday, November 16th. Louis Riel, convicted of treason, is sent to the gallows. Street demonstrations and protests erupt in Montreal. Riel, the speechmakers say, is one of our own. His death is our death. Thousands upon thousands of words for Riel. On the day of his execution, there are 20 reported deaths from smallpox. All but one, children. The youngest, 1 year and 1 month. The oldest, 9 years and 6 months. Riel gets all the attention. The children, none.
Diane Cadot, 1 year, 6 months. H. Charbonneau, 3 years. Marie Tessier, 1 year, 11 months. Oscar Sigouin, 1 year, 3 months. E. Menard, 3 years, 6 months. Amanda Leroux, 3 years, 3 months. Arthur Fréjeau, 4 years.
And as the month of the dead comes to an end, the bells toll on for those taken by the plague. Though no one will ever know the exact numbers, by the end of 1885, 20,000 or so have been stricken with smallpox, one out of every 10 in the city. Of those, close to 5,000 have died. 90% of the dead are French Catholics, the vast majority children under the age of 10. The day before Christmas, the last victim is buried, a 6-year-old child whose parents refused to allow her to be vaccinated. As the year comes to an end, so does the smallpox. The vulnerable have all been taken, and the survivors are safe, for now.
It's been a dramatic year for Montreal. Some are saying the worst year for the city since the last smallpox epidemic in the 1880s. Over 11,000 people infected with smallpox and a final death toll of 2,806.
At the end of December, the World Health Organization lifts the quarantine on Montreal, and health officials announce the epidemic is officially over.
All Montrealers seem to want now is a return to life as it was before.
I think public health through immunization and other means has reduced infectious disease to a level where it's become invisible until these more severe outbreaks occur. I think that infectious disease of various descriptions is very likely to keep coming and coming. So rather than just disease-specific plans, we have to have a sort of all-hazard infectious disease response as well.
I think we made pretty well all the mistakes we can make with an infectious disease with SARS, and hopefully we won't make them next time when it is really something serious.
I guess I have to be reminded from time to time how thin the veneer of civilization can be. The lessons of 1885 and the great age of infectious disease, we thought we had all learned by, say, the 1960s, and then we sort of forgot them, and they had to be relearned all over again with AIDS. They had to be learned all over again with SARS. If the smallpox virus ever is let loose on a civilian population, we will see an awful lot of what we saw in the 19th century repeat itself, and we'd better be ready for it.
Some of the details of our scenario may be speculation. How many dead? How many infected? How people would react? The mistakes that would be made? What is certain, however, is that an epidemic or pandemic is coming. Will we be ready when it does?
First cases of an unidentified, highly contagious virus. No one knows how it arrived in the city and from where, but authorities there say there is no reason for alarm and the outbreak is under control.